que las autoridades cumplan con su deber y hagan una investigación seria para encontrar y llevar ante la justicia a los asesinos de María Isabel.
Bueno, la última vez que vi a María Isabel con vida fue aproximadamente las 5 de la tarde del domingo 16 de diciembre de 2001. Le di permiso a trabajar y yo le iba a dejar comida, a veces almuerzo, a veces pues refacción. Y en esa ocasión yo le fui a dejar refacción y le pregunté, te vengo a traer, no tengas pena, me dijo, me van a ir a la casa. Esa noche no vino a dormir María Isabel y yo me puse a pensar, pero ¿por qué no vino, va? Ella, cuando quería un permiso, pues ella me lo pedía. Entonces yo decía, tal vez al día siguiente va a venir, va. No pensé nada malo, va. El día siguiente yo empecé a buscarla, me fui a buscar al trabajo y no sabían nada de ella, los compañeros de trabajo, y yo puse la denuncia en la Policía Nacional el día siguiente, el 17 de diciembre de 2001, puse la denuncia en la Policía Nacional Civil, en lo que antes se llamaba Servicio de Investigación Criminológica. Entonces, desde ese entonces, yo pienso que si en esos momentos la policía hubiera actuado, hubiera investigado, tal vez María Isabel hubiera aparecido con vida. Fue hasta el día 18 de diciembre, en la noche, que yo ya vine cansadísima, pero agotada, a buscar. Y según yo iba a descansar, dije, voy a poner la noticia. Dije yo, mire, como que Dios me dijo encender la tele, ¿va? Para ver la noticia de que ahí estaba mi hija tirada. La habían encontrado en un terreno baldío. Y por la ropa la reconocí, estaba boca abajo. Cuando yo fui a la morgue a reconocer el cadáver de mi hija, y me costó mucho reconocerla porque estaba muy golpeada. Me desmayé. Y la policía de ahí que estaba ahí cuidando la morgue, me dijeron, sálgase señora porque usted está loca. Y, ¿cómo me van a sacar? Les decía, ahí está mi hija, no es un perro el que mataron. Las autoridades encargadas, que son las del Ministerio Público y la Policía Nacional en este caso, más que nada el Ministerio Público falló definitivamente hasta la fecha. Es nefasta la actitud, la respuesta, no solo en el caso de mi hija, sino que en el de tantísimas miles de mujeres que han asesinado. Por eso, esa razón, puesto que no allanaron, imagínense que el lugar donde introdujeron el vehículo que usaron, fueron a allanar a los 3 años, imagínense, y a preguntar si habían visto un carro con las características de un carro, el último modelo que habían informado, porque hubo un individuo que gracias a Dios vio y llamó al 110, que es el Servicio Nacional de la Policía Nacional. Ahí esa persona no se identificó, pero dijo que había visto cuando bajaron del baúl de un carro de último modelo a mi hija, y él llamó para que fueran a allanar el lugar donde metieron la casa, el carro, es otra colonia. Y nunca fueron a llenar, a los 3 años fueron a llenar, imagínense, yo voy a luchar. Y le prometí a María Isabel que iba a luchar porque se le hiciera justicia, porque su nombre quedara en limpio, en alto, porque era una niña. Toda mujer que matan, todas son prostitutas, según las noticias, todas son mareras. ¿Cómo oyeren? ¿Cómo saben? Y aunque fuesen, tienen alta obligación las autoridades de hacer justicia e investigar.
El feminicidio en Guatemala afecta a toda la sociedad en su conjunto. Las diferentes organizaciones han tenido muchísima dificultad para elaborar un perfil de las víctimas. Primero, por lo generalizado del fenómeno, y segundo, por la escasa o nula información que sistematiza el Estado. En consecuencia, se ha creado una situación propicia para los crímenes contra las mujeres y para la impunidad, que deja a más del 96% de los asesinatos sin una sentencia condenatoria. Para Sebastián Elgueta, investigador de Amnistía Internacional en Guatemala, esto se evidencia en la discriminación latente que persiste en las autoridades en cuanto a las investigaciones.
Por parte de Amnistía Internacional estamos poniendo en relieve el asunto y otra vez marcando las fallas que el Estado tiene para investigar efectivamente los asesinatos y poner a los responsables ante la justicia. Pero sí hemos visto que hay fallas fundamentales en la efectividad de la investigación y persecución penal por parte del Estado en cuanto a homicidios de mujeres. Los resultados de los diferentes esfuerzos estatales para mejorar la investigación y prevenir el asesinato de mujeres no han dado resultados concretos. Como usted bien notó al comienzo, murieron 685 mujeres. mujeres en el 2010, en el año anterior fueron un número bastante similar. Entonces, a pesar de haber pasado leyes y a pesar de haber creado nuevas instancias para supuestamente mejorar la investigación y persecución penal, hemos visto que concretamente los resultados han sido iguales. O sea, no ha mejorado la situación para la mujer en Guatemala.
Y es que en Guatemala ocurre lo mismo que en la mexicana Ciudad Juárez. Muchas de las autoridades asocian y de alguna manera justifican los asesinatos diciendo que las víctimas pertenecían a las maras u otras bandas juveniles y en algunos casos recurriendo a la frase de algo habrán hecho.
Por lo que entiendo, la situación en Juárez es una situación en donde jóvenes, trabajadores, mujeres de diferentes sectores de la sociedad pues son asesinadas y hay poca investigación y hay discriminación dentro de las autoridades estatales en cuanto a la investigación. En ese sentido, sí hay bastantes similaridades con la situación en Guatemala, en donde también vemos que las autoridades tienen una tendencia a culpar a la víctima, como que si fuera culpa de ella, que fue asesinada, y tienen una tendencia a tomar en cuenta, cuando no deberían, el asunto de género. Es decir, menospreciar a la familia y menospreciar a la víctima.
El problema en Guatemala es que con un índice altísimo de asesinatos de mujeres, también se da una altísima tasa de impunidad.
Este miércoles, el sexto tribunal colegiado en materia administrativa del primer circuito de México revocó la suspensión de la exhibición del documental Presunto Culpable ordenado por la juez Blanca Lobo. Así lo dio a conocer a la Radio del Sur Laida Negrete, abogada y productora del documental, donde se muestra la ineficacia y corrupción del sistema penal mexicano. Negrete advirtió que la misma jueza Blanca Lobo, que suspendió las proyecciones de Presunto Culpable, puede reiterar su decisión este viernes.
La juez federal, en su decisión de entrar a una demanda que recibió por parte de uno de los que aparecen en el juicio, decidió sacar a Presunto Culpable de las pantallas y prohibir la proyección de Presunto Culpable en todo el país. Y esto enfureció más a toda la ciudadanía. Tenemos buenas noticias y noticias de cautela. Buenas noticias es que el día de ayer un tribunal superior revocó la decisión de la juez. Presunto Culpable, desde hace unas 2 horas, se está volviendo a ver en las pantallas de México. Esta buena noticia. La noticia de cautela es que el viernes la juez puede insistir de nuevo en una decisión a la cual tiene facultades para emitir de nuevo la suspensión de Presunto Culpable. Entonces estamos en un momento de mucha vicisitud en términos del destino de la película, pero de mucha claridad acerca del destino de la ciudadanía y de lo que quiere la ciudadanía en México. Estamos empezando a ver reacciones fantásticas donde queremos que por fin se abran la puerta de los juzgados y podamos ver y evaluar la justicia que tenemos en México.
El documental Presunto Culpable ha sido visto por casi 1 millón de mexicanos en 2 semanas de estarse exhibiendo en los cines, un récord histórico en el país. Y llegamos al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro agradecimiento a todos los medios que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. Coming up next on Free Radio, it's Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, March 10th, 2011. And in 15 minutes, an interview with author and revolutionary researcher Robert Whitaker, author of Mad in America and Anatomy of an Epidemic. Stay tuned. that plunky plunk was Eli Charleston's Baby Bumblebee from Ragged Time. He's a street performer that I ran into, gosh, a couple weeks ago. And he remembered me from 5 years ago, and I kind of vaguely maybe remembered him. He had a new CD out, and this is one of the songs from it. You'll be hearing more. I like to support street performers downtown. So as mentioned before, you are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Freak Radio, depending on how you want to put it. We are at 101.1. We are at freakradio.org. That's also the website to go to if you want to become a member of the collective, which means you actually, generally speaking, you get a show, and you contribute money for the rent of the studio, and you can also participate in the decisions around the station. You know, is it legal to smoke in the studio? And what do we do if the FCC comes? And all those questions. So if you're interested, you can download an application at freakradio.org. That's one word, small letters, Freak Radio. And you can also get more information by, if you've got a question, you can, of course, email. Or you can leave a voicemail message at our voicemail message line. And that's 427-4523, 427-4523. Now, this show has two call-in numbers. One of them is going to be taken, I hope, by author Robert Whitaker in about 12 or 13 minutes, assuming he calls in, which I'm hoping he does. The other one will be free, and I'm not quite sure which one he's calling in on, so the other one is the one to use, and I will, once he gets on the air, announce the other one again for those of you who have questions for Robert or Bob, as I believe he is known by, although the name of his book is under the name Robert. It's going to be Robert and Bob tonight. I'm Robert Norse. He's Robert Whitaker. And the two phone numbers, if you want to call in before then, is 427-4523, 427-that's the message phone number. I'll get this straight. It's 427-3772. Again, one more time, 427-3772 is the number if you want to actually get on the air. And one way to remember that, in case you don't remember numbers well, is it's FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 3772. The other number is 469-3119, 469-3119. And grab a pencil if you'd like and write that down in case you've got questions. You can also, well, you can ask them at those numbers, 427-3772, 469-3119, area code 831 for those of you who are outside the area. Or you can email me, and I'll try to keep an eye on incoming emails. I'm at rnorse3, R-N-O-R-S-E, like in Norseman, 3 at hotmail.com. So that's another option that you have there. And again, this show is going to be a discussion of a couple of Robert's books. His most recent book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, and his earlier book, Mad in America. He's written other books, but these are the two I'm really interested in. And they have to do with his research into the efficacy of psychiatric drugs and the history of psychiatric treatment in America. And this is, you might say, what does this have to do with low-income people and homeless people? And it's true, it's kind of, it's a broader topic and one that impacts a lot of other people, but there's a significant portion of people who are labeled homeless or who are out there on the streets who are have mental health disabilities. Or there are plenty of people, low-income and otherwise, who have all kinds of life problems, and they find themselves directed to pharmaceutical cocktails, which I've never been a fan of. And that's kind of the bias I bring to this. But as Robert Whitaker will tell you, or as you may know if you've read his stuff, he was actually a conventional supporter of psychiatric medication. And actually, he began his work in the late 90s by kind of being concerned that people who were doing drug studies were being, psychiatric patients were being denied their medication in some sort of, you know, double-blind placebo experiment where one group would get it and one group wouldn't. You could see which had a better effect, you know, which drug worked better, did the drug work better than the placebo, which it means the they don't get anything, but they think it's the same thing as a drug, and so you see which, you know, if there's any difference in the outcomes. And he then became convinced and has assembled a lot of persuasive information around the fact that psychiatric medications, though they may have good consequences for some people, and he didn't recommend that they be abandoned entirely at all, but that there's been a huge outburst and upsurge in psychiatric medication, and there's a huge mythology around it being some kind of a cure, a magic bullet that simply is not justified by the long-term outcomes of the results of psychiatrically medicating people in the United States and other countries, and that these results are actually pretty well known and pretty well documented, but have also been, up to now, pretty thoroughly ignored. So we're going to be looking at that, and that's coming up in about 10 minutes. You can go online to Google for Robert Whitaker, W-H-I-T-A-K-E-R, and look up his blog and his website. And the name of the book is one way to get at it. I think there's another Robert Whitaker that isn't him that may be a little confusing. He's a politician or something. But if you look for Mad in America or Anatomy of an Epidemic, you'll find him and his blog, and you'll be able to kind of check into what's going on, because he's a pretty articulate writer, very, very detailed, and can be a little tiring to read through the many studies, but also can be rewarding. I didn't entirely get through his book, Anatomy of an Epidemic. I got through about two-thirds of it, and still working on it. It actually gets, it's interesting every time I pick it up, but it can also wear you out, or at least it wears me out at certain points. But let me talk about a few other things before that happens, because the show covers other topics, or at least tries to. Another issue, of course, is what's going on with homeless people outside in terms of the legal situation. I've talked in the past about the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz, the laws that criminalize covering up with a blanket, falling asleep after 11 o'clock at night, putting up protective tents against the rain, even though we know there's no shelter for 95% of the homeless population. And the shelter providers that the city officially sends you to will tell you there's a waiting list. You can't get on immediately, with some exceptions in the winter when the armory is open. But the armory only deals with 75, and maybe you can cram in 100 people. So we're talking about 1,500 to 2,000 homeless out there. Some say it's a lesser number of 1,000, but whatever it is, it's certainly not 100 or 200, and so there are plenty of folks who don't have access to shelter. And the latest kind of wrinkle in this whole situation, what I've been talking about, is the law that the city council and the city attorney passed in response to a massive homeless protest throughout July, August, and September under the name Peace Camp 2010. And those people are now going to trial for the crime of sleeping outside and politically protesting peacefully and persistently to change the laws that make homeless people criminals at night if they fall asleep, even though they have no legal place to fall asleep in the city of Santa Cruz. And really, in the county of Santa Cruz, too, although the laws are somewhat different on a county basis. Well, then the wrinkle in the city has been that the city attorney brought to law to the city council that said, well, if you're on a waiting list, you can get your ticket dismissed, and the sleeping ban and camping ban and blanket ban won't apply to you, although we can still ticket you, the police can still search you, pat you down, order you to move, and even in theory jail you if it's a repeat offense, and if they feel you're going to commit the offense again. Police have various pretexts for jailing people on infraction crimes that they shouldn't be using, but that they have used in the past. Well, this is an ordinance that passed in September, went into effect at the end of October, and according to activist Steve Plaich, who's been keeping an eye on this and talking to the city attorney's office, they have already dismissed a few of the, I guess it's three of the, I don't know, 90-odd citations that have come in over October, November, and December. And those are we just got recent figures on this. But the other citations haven't been dismissed. Now you can say, well, were they on the waiting list? Did they sign up for the waiting list at the Homeless Service Center? Because that's what the law requires, either they be signed up on a waiting list or that the Winter Armory shelter, the armory, be full to capacity, which it often is, but sometimes isn't. And I don't have, that's one thing I don't have the figures on, which is the nights when the armory was full in the last 3 months. And it's open from November 15th to April 15th. But again, even if it's not full, there are plenty of reasons people don't get to the armory. It requires lining up relatively early in the day, like 3:15, 4:15, thereabouts. And it requires not having much property with you. It requires not having your pet with you if you have a pet. It requires you can't take your vehicle there. You have to have picture ID, I believe, still. Though, full disclosure, I believe the Homeless Service Center says it will help you get that kind of ID. I'm not sure how effective they are in doing that or how long the delay is. The circumstances are you sleep in one large room with everybody else. There may be a lot of coughing going on. It may, for some people, for vets, for instance, be considered difficult for them to deal with. They may not be comfortable in that situation. In fact, they may be paranoid in that situation. And for other people, it may not be healthy for other reasons, too. You've got one or two sick people, and other people can get ill as well. Though there's been no studies made that I'm aware of disease spreading through the armory. And, you know, for some people, it's a viable solution, especially if it's raining. You know, it's good to have a place to go to. But, in fact, it's not a good pretext for ticketing people and saying, well, we'll give you a ticket, but if the armory is full or if you sign up on a waiting list for a non-existent place, we'll dismiss it. But let's be very practical and say, well, if you're signing up for a waiting list and that removes your criminal liability, that's a good thing. Why don't people just line up in a long line and go to the Homeless Service Center at 115 Coral Street and sign up on that waiting list? Well, I've been asking people to go do that and tell me what their experiences are. And there's one fellow who actually, his legal case prompted the Peace Camp 2010 that began on July 4th and lasted until the first few days in November. And some say it's still going on for a few people that are continuing somewhat surreptitiously to sleep outside around the county building. But this is Robert Blind Bear Facer, who's a kind of a, he's an Amish minister. He's a boat maker. He's a guy in his early 60s who sort of a very colorful fellow, kind of clad all and looks like buckskin. I'm not quite sure what he actually it is. He's got a feather in his cap, plays the guitar downtown. He originally was ticketed on a night when there was zero shelter, and they admitted this, that during the summer, early fall, and late spring, there is no shelter for people. You can get on a waiting list, but you can't get shelter. And that was a couple years ago, and they didn't have this provision of the law, but they still had the necessity defense, which says if you haven't got a place to go and you have a need to sleep, you can't be criminalized for sleeping. That's what the necessity defense, in essence, in these cases means. And the judges still found him guilty. I think it was either Commissioner Baskett or could have been Judge Simons. Not sure. In any case, attorney Ed Fry wanted to appeal his case, and they delayed that appeal. So Ed was very upset, and in order to show that the right to sleep could not wait 3 months on this appeal, he went down, rented a porta potty, rolled out his sleeping bag, and he and I and a bunch of other folks began sleeping in front of the county building. I stayed there for about 5 days and then just kept coming back to get reports. Ed stayed there I would say at least two or three nights out of every week he'd be down there. He was arrested, and he's now defending those people in court, including himself in court, against misdemeanor charges. Not just the sleeping ban, but a more powerful or a harsher state law called the lodging law. So in any case, what the situation is the argument that, well, you know, ordinary people who aren't protesting or just trying to sleep at night were faced with a police officer coming up and saying, hey, you're sleeping at night illegally. You can't sleep after 11 o'clock at night. Other than, oh dear, sounds like an incoming call. Well, we'll be taking up this conversation later, because I think I know who that is, and I think it's a call I want to take. but we'll be discussing the issue of what happens when you go to the homeless service center and you try to get on the waiting list. And I have a report on that. But first, let's see who's on the line. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, hi, Robert. This is Bob Whitaker.
Ah, sitting in the airport, are you, Bob?
I am sitting in the airport. Excellent. Hopefully it'll be quiet.
I sound pretty clear. I can hear you.
Good.
So I've introduced you a little bit as the author of at least two books that I'm particularly interested in, Mad in America and Anatomy of an Epidemic.
Right.
I should also say that you've been on this show in the past, in the last, oh gosh, I think it was a number of years ago, and then perhaps a little more recently. I've been encouraging you to continue this research which you've been doing, and to find a publisher, which you did. And here you are being, you know, wined and dined and transported all over the country. What's that all about?
Well, this book seems to have, stirred things up. And so people have, coming at this whole subject of psychiatry from different angles are sort of inviting me to speak and discussing the implications of this book, Anatomy of an Epidemic. So I'm getting invitations from, user groups, from county agencies, state aids, state groups, psychiatric groups, and so I've literally been traveling pretty steadily since last August, and it just keeps going. I think this is my third or fourth trip to California in the last 4 or 5 months, so it's good. I think what's happening is people are really, in response to this book, I mean, some people are threatened by it, but thinking that maybe they have to make some changes. I mean, I think they're seeing it as a pretty fundamental challenge to the medical model and the prevailing paradigm of care.
Now, I've given a kind of, two-paragraph description of my sense of what you're writing about in the book, which is, in the first book, The History of Psychiatry, and its previous psychiatric methods and how weird and strange it all is.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
And then in this, and also in both the first and second books, analyzing the efficacy of psychiatric medications by the words and scientific studies of those who've actually delved into a lot of scientific trials and research on them, and over the long term, over the short term, and your conclusion that though they may help some people, that the long term benefits apparently either just don't really justify the amount of propaganda put into the pharmaceuticals, and actually may have increased the disability rate significantly, although it's hard to say what actually does increase the disability rate.
Right. Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. I mean, what I did in this last book in particular, but I did it somewhat in the first book, but in Anatomy of an Epidemic, I was really, the disability numbers became a start for asking questions, really. So if you just, one of the things is we have this belief system that, Thorazine comes in 1955, and that kicks off this, quote, psychopharmacological revolution. I mean, this is the conventional wisdom, and we get all these, we get antipsychotics, antidepressants, anti-anxiety agents, and this dramatically improves sort of the treatment of mental disorders, psychiatric disorders. That's the wisdom, the conventional thought. And if that's true, at the very least, you shouldn't see disability rates going up. And yet, during the past 50 years, the number of people, on disability, or, well, in 1955, they were in state and county hospitals, but even let's just look for the last 20 years, from 1987 to 2007, when people on SSI or SSDI due to psychiatric disorder, well, that's soared. That's gone from 1.25 million people to 4 million adults. Now, as you say, there may actually be a number of factors that are contributing to that. Poverty, sort of welfare reduction, lack of jobs, all sorts of things. But nevertheless, that rising disability number due to psychiatric problems raises an obvious question. Well, how do these medications affect long-term outcomes? And when you focus on that, long-term outcomes, and you're also right on this, all I'm doing is, as a journalist, I'm just going through and piecing together an answer to that question and piecing it together by, mainstream long-term outcome studies, basically. And as you say, the research of, in essence, biological psychiatry and the words of those who conducted the research. And I think the surprising thing, and this shows up over and over again, is that, you know, sure, there's people helped acutely by psychiatric medication sometimes, and I think there's people, and I know such people, who say that the drugs have helped them long term, and you know, that has to be honored and respected. But in the aggregate, in terms of how medication shapes, sort of shape the long-term outcome of schizophrenia or psychotic disorders, or how medications shape the long-term course of bipolar disorder, depression, boy, time and time again, what you see is that this paradigm of care sort of increases the chronicity of the disorder. In other words, people tend to be more symptomatic long-term as opposed to what they were before. You see that a certain percentage of people end up with more and new and more severe psychiatric symptoms as time passes on. And you see other sort of problems creep in, such as physical problems with people on meds long-term. You do see some cognitive problems. Frankly, you see some early death that's becoming ever more pronounced. So this is not data that really speaks of a paradigm of care that's working. In fact, it's not working at all. So I think the bottom line message of Anatomy of an Epidemic is, you know, the medications do help some people short-term. Some people will find them helpful long-term. But our paradigm of care that emphasizes sort of put everybody on these drugs and keep them on long-term, that sort of one-size-fits-all, that's a broken paradigm of care. And I would say it's doing a fair amount of harm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Well, I would say so, yes, given the fact that... I came to that conclusion actually 30 years ago, but it wasn't based on, you know, a rigorous study of the scientific data.
Just right. It just took me a while to catch up on.
Well, I don't know. It was anecdotal and was based on experience with people I know that were close to me and so forth. But you've been struggling to this, you know, you originally came to this, I guess you first kind of happened upon this when you looked at World Health Organization data almost a decade ago. And you found that their studies showed better recovery rates for those who didn't use medications in third world countries than in Western countries.
Yeah, you know, I think this is important. You know, I came about this through this back door that you're talking about here. And when I began this thing, I was a complete believer in the conventional wisdom. I mean, I'd been a medical journalist at a newspaper and had been, you know, I completely believed the conventional story, which was that these drugs fix chemical imbalances in the brain and had greatly improved outcomes. But what you're referring to is I was doing a series for the Boston Globe in 1998, and I came upon these outcome studies by the World Health Organization that found that at 2 and 5 years, outcomes were much, much better for schizophrenia patients in the poor countries of the world, specifically India, Colombia, and Nigeria, than in the U.S. and other rich countries. These were studies that compared outcomes across 10 countries. And, you know, I wanted to know why. That didn't make sense. And I was particularly struck when the World Health Organization investigators concluded that living in a developed country is, quote, a strong predictor that you will never fully recover from schizophrenia. And I'm like, well, why would that be? And I asked people why it might be, and then I also then began looking. I went back to the study itself. It was a long, long paper, and then I found in there something that just blew me away, and that was that in the poor countries, only 16% of patients were regularly maintained on antipsychotic drugs. So here you had in this study a paradigm of use of drugs that was so different than our paradigm of use here. And, of course, we're told that everybody has to be on anybody with that diagnosis has to be on antipsychotics all their lives. And yet, where did you see the best outcomes? You saw them in poor countries where the vast majority of people weren't being kept on the drugs long term. So that began my inquiry and investigation into the scientific literature to see if there was another story to be found there. And that's what you find, that the scientific literature documents a very different story than the story told to the public and that nourishes and sort of the common beliefs in our society.
Now, you, in your book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, you not only give an interesting kind of chronology and background to each of the different psychiatric wonder drugs, as they like to think of themselves, or they're so described, and where they came from. And you point out that unlike drugs that deal with other physical ailments, like, I don't know, diabetes or strep or, you know, like penicillin, you don't actually have a model of an illness to which you can really relate the drug and say, oh, we're going to fix this particular thing. This is what's wrong.
Yeah, I think this is really important and something that history can reveal to us. So the antibiotics really come into American medicine right after World War II. That's when the capacity to manufacture penicillin and other antibiotics in commercial amounts happens. And, of course, antibiotics are magic bullets, right? I mean, at that time, there they are eradicating bacterial infections that could be, you know, horrible and even lethal. But what happens there is you have, in that model, you have an agent, a bacterium that can even be seen, and then you have a drug that kills that bacterium without causing real damage to the host tissue. That's the magic bullet. And what we have in conventional wisdom and in the naming of the drugs that arrived in psychiatry in the 1950s is seemingly the same thing. So we have antipsychotics, and the sense with that name is that the drugs are anti contradict some biology that causes psychosis. And we have antidepressants, as if they're specific agents to depression and so forth. Well, there's two things you discover when you go into the discovery of those drugs. You find that they were all developed for other uses, and then, you know, the compounds, and then they were introduced into psychiatry because of their adverse effects. So, for example, chlorpromazine came from a group of drugs, phenothiazines, that were really developed for use in surgery as sort of novel anesthetic agents. And they were introduced into psychiatry after people noticed that they sort of caused an emotional blunting similar to what was seen in surgical lobotomy. So they said, hey, surgical lobotomy at that time was seen as quite good. This side effect of this anesthetic drug shows that it could cause a change similar to what you might see sometimes with lobotomy, and therefore it might have a use in asylum medicine as basically an agent that would quiet people, sedate people, tranquilize people. I mean, it was introduced as a major tranquilizer, not as an antipsychotic. Similarly, the first antidepressants, those drugs came out of research searching for a magic bullet for TB, for tuberculosis. And what happens is when they gave a particular drug to TB patients, they found that some of the patients were sort of roused, almost as if it stirred some sort of manic, response in the patients. So people said, well, if that happens, maybe they might have a use as in, you know, for people in depressed patients. But again, the drug was developed as a magic bullet for against TB. And I could give you a similar story about the first anti-anxiety agents. They actually were muscle relaxants. So that's how the drugs came, because of their side effects. That's why they were introduced into psychiatry. And then what happened was they get this renaming, as psychiatry begins to want to have its own magic bullets. They get renamed. The major tranquilizers get renamed antipsychotics. The minor tranquilizers get named anti-anxiety agents. The first antidepressants were actually called psychic stimulators, and they get renamed antidepressants. Now, once that renaming happens, people start fooling themselves into thinking that these drugs must be fixing something biological in the brain. So the next step of this whole chemical imbalance story is they learn how the drugs act on the brain. So, for example, they learn that antipsychotics, quote, work by blocking dopamine receptors in the brain. In other words, thwarting dopaminergic transmission. So they hypothesize at that point that schizophrenia is caused by too much dopamine. And in a somewhat similar, according to similar logic or illogic, they find that antidepressants work by, say, blocking the reuptake of serotonin, therefore theoretically increasing serotonergic activity. So they say, maybe depression is caused by low serotonin.
Now, these conclusions, this whole approach is undertaken, I presume, because they think that patients who are so diagnosed are getting better because of these medications, and therefore they're trying to say, well, there's a mechanism operating here that must be producing a better effect. Is that what we're saying here?
Well, in sort of. Yes, so they do these, they get these drugs and they do these tests, these short-term tests, and the people given these drugs do better over the short term than those given placebo. In other words, let's say the depressive symptoms remit more, at least a little bit more than those given placebo. So the doctors or the researchers say, aha, they must be fixing something biological. They must be targeting something biological. That's one motive for coming up with this idea that they're antidepressants and fixing something. But there's also another thing operating here, and that is that psychiatry wants its magic bullets in the same way that infectious medicine has its bullets. So there's a little bit of wishful thinking going on here, and there's also a little bit of, you know, a profession trying to raise its sort of its profile in society, sort of what they're saying, you know, we're white coat doctors like those in infectious medicine. So there's some wishful thinking going on here as well. But when the next point I think you're getting at here is, well, did they actually find that people with, say, depression had low serotonin? Or did they actually find that people with diagnosed with schizophrenia had overactive dopamine systems? And they did investigate those questions in the 1970s, starting in the 1970s and early 1980s.
This was the brain chemistry theory of mental illness, right, that you say, we still hear about this today, but your Anatomy of an Epidemic notes that this was kind of discredited in the 1980s, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's the amazing thing, that this whole story about chemical imbalances is kept alive all this time. So the investigations to see if people so diagnosed actually had such chemical imbalances was done in the 1970s, or started in the 1970s. And, you know, boy, it does extend into the 1980s and 1990s. But actually, time and time again, they were concluding that, you know, in unmedicated patients, they just weren't seeing these abnormalities. So as early as 1984, for example, the National Institute of Mental Health concluded, boy, it doesn't look like there's anything wrong with the serotonergic system in people who are depressed. And you see some similar conclusions being made about the dopamine hypothesis of schizophrenia in the 80s. And by the early 1990s, you see sort of mainstream researchers said, oh, the dopamine hypothesis of schizophrenia retains little credibility. But we weren't being told that. The public wasn't being told that. You can find, going back to the serotonin theory of depression, time and time again, people aren't finding that people have low serotonin. And then you can find a book called Essential Psychopharmacology in 2000, and that's written by Stephen Stahl, who's a major molecular psychiatrist. And he believes in molecular psychiatry in the sense that there's this biological psychiatry to be found. But what does he write in this book? He says there is no compelling evidence that low serotonin is causing depression. He says that is this whole theory, there is no real deficit. In other words, it's a myth. It's a delusion that the profession and our society is now suffering from.
Now, you've been talking not merely to groups that are sympathetic to you, anti-psychiatry groups and maybe neutral groups. You've been to some pretty prestigious hospitals and medical centers recently, as I understand it, by kind of vaguely following what you've been up to on your blog.
Yeah, that's right. I'm increasingly getting invited by physician groups, you know, by groups of psychiatrists or, you know, county mental health agencies, that sort of thing.
I mean, do they want to spar with you? I mean, are they still upholding the brain chemistry theory of mental illness? Do they claim these things are still, in spite of the evidence that you're presenting, an explanation for, you know, depression and schizophrenia and whatever?
No, listen, we can talk about how those talks go, because they're quite interesting, and sometimes they're pretty contentious and difficult. But nobody, I will tell you, nobody in these many, many talks I've given has defended the chemical imbalance story. If anything, they'll say, well, that didn't pan out. That's an outdated model. And I in one forum, this was at Massachusetts General Hospital, Grand Round, which was a pretty contentious time, I was sort of saying to the psychiatrist in the room, you know, you betrayed us. You led us into the belief this false story that these drugs fix chemical imbalances. There was actually some comments at that time as, oh, we haven't been telling patients that for 25 years. We know that's an outdated model. You know, the evidence didn't show up. And I said, well, I don't think the public got the message. Because actually there was a recent survey that found that I think 80% of Americans now understand that depression is due to a chemical imbalance, due to low serotonin. Well, that's a story of a marketing effort to support the use of those drugs that is peddling a false story, but it has spread this delusion.
And yet,
but I will tell you, among the professionals, nobody has defended that story.
And I also, it seems to me, if I recall from an interview you gave with the newspaper Street Spirit about 6 years ago, you talked about, and you still, I think, have talked about in more recently, maybe it was in the earlier Anatomy of an Epidemic article that you wrote, which preceded the book, the explosion of psychiatric medication. And you also, of course, note now the explosion of disability classifications and payments that have happened. And if they're not defending the brain chemistry, brain balance, chemical balance model, what's the defense for these pharmaceuticals? Are they disputing your analysis of the technical surveys you've amassed, or are they coming up with new evidence, or are they just repeating a discredited mythology and from a position of authority where they can continue to do that?
Well, one sort of new argument, it doesn't really make a lot, in a certain way, it doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of as a justification necessarily for the medications is, well, you hear people say, okay, so it's not a chemical imbalance, but we're finding these other sort of biological abnormalities. And we could get into whether they're really finding that, but I'm just telling you that's what they assert. They said, well, we're finding this dysfunction in this region of the brain, or this sort of semi-dysfunction. And the reason, though, that argument is the argument they're telling themselves is a reason to justify sort of lifetime use of the drugs, is that, oh, well, it's still a biological disorder. But the reason this is fallacious is that, first of all, I'm not quite sure that research is very solid. But more importantly, you still have to ask, even if there were something biological found, you still have to ask, well, does the drug remedy that problem? Is it a treatment for that problem?
Or, as you point out, and, does it create the problem?
Yeah, that's the answer to, well, it's still sort of, well, we think there's still something biologically going on. Well, that doesn't mean just because you throw, a drug at it that's going to help that, whatever that problem is. I think one of the things what you're talking about here, Robert, is conceptually to think about how the drugs act on the brain is this. We don't know what's wrong. When I say we, I mean, the researchers in this field don't know what's wrong. So what do the drugs do? Well, they perturb neurotransmitter systems, and the way they throw a wrench into the operating of those systems, the brain tries to compensate for the presence of the drug and goes through these compensatory adaptations. And at the end of this process, this is a phrase from Stephen Hyman, who he wrote a paper in 1996 on this whole thing. He says, the brain is operating in a manner that is both qualitatively and quantitatively different than normal. Now, once you understand that science and that sort of conceptualization of the drugs, you can understand two things really fast, or three things. One, you can understand why they might have a lot of side effects, because you're not fixing any known problem, but you are sort of interrupting or perturbing normal function, so you can see why that might cause some problems, have a pretty problematic side effect profile. That's number one. Number two, once you understand that the brain compensates, adapts to the presence of the drug, goes through these changes, you can understand why going off the drugs can be so difficult, because the brain has been changed to sort of expect the presence of the drug, and now when you withdraw the drug, in essence, it is sort of out of balance in an odd way. And you can think about this, in essence, imagine a drug like heroin. Well, the brain adapts to the presence of heroin, and then when if you try to go off heroin, as everybody knows, you have this withdrawal symptoms. Well, maybe the withdrawal symptoms are different, of a different intensity, different type with psychiatric drugs, but the basic sort of model there is similar in that the brain has compensated for the presence of the drug, gone through these adaptations, you remove the drug, and you have these, withdrawal problems. So that shows up. And then I think the third thing you can conceive of better when you, once you have this conception of psychiatric drugs, is that since we don't know what's wrong, since psychiatry doesn't know what's wrong, and you have a drug that perturbs things and then the brain, you know, adapts to it, well, you can see why that might produce problematic long-term effects, right? So I think the conceptualizing of the drugs in this manner leads you to understand why the outcomes literature and the side effect literature is so very problematic.
Well, I guess, you know, the issue also is if you look at conditions that are diagnosed or called schizophrenia or whatever, manic depression or bipolar or whatever, you have some new technologies which allow for brain scans and things of this sort. Has there been any correlation of people who do not, and I know they're going to be kind of hard to find because drugs are so prevalent and so widely pushed in Western countries, but have you seen any research that shows correlations of physical anomalies with these diagnosed conditions for people who haven't been heavily medicated?
Right. So you're asking, in sort of medication-naive patients, do you see brain abnormalities, right?
That can somehow be correlated with these diagnoses so that you can say, you know, this is linked to that, the set of symptoms and so forth.
No, I don't think there's anything. I don't think there's anything that specific where you say whatever sort of presumed change is linked to any symptoms. And even, you know, what happens with these MRI scans? You know, they scan a lot of people, and then they make a composite, and then they compare that composite to some sort of supposed normal composite. But one of the things you find when you do that, virtually any group that you study of any disease, right? I mean, of any sort of medical group, or even if, let's say, you took a scan of cab drivers, okay, taxi cab drivers, you scan their brain, and then you create a composite MRI scan of the cab driver's brain, and you compare that to, quote, a normal brain. Well, it won't be the same. That doesn't mean it's pathological. And the reason it won't be the same, and the reason I'm using this is because there's actually been done some research on this. Cab drivers, because they spend so much time on streets and sort of navigating streets, the area of the brain that is given over to sort of, you know, sort of, what is the word for it, spatial navigating, is actually a little bit enlarged. Well, that's not pathological, obviously. That's a sign that the brain has put some resources and has been taxed by this task that it does all the time.
Right.
But that's one of the things you see is almost any group you have of people and compare them to some sort of normal, it's not going to be quite normal. So
sure, but there are, you know, not that I'm particularly in agreement with these huge numbers of classifications or even the broad categories of classifications, schizophrenia and depression,
right,
and so forth. But if you take those broad categories,
right,
that, and you look at those symptoms, that's different than a cab driver. And, you know, if you find things that are, seem to be uniquely linked in imagery to those,
right,
particular states, provided you can differentiate that from, you know, people who have been essentially crippled or, let us say, heavily impacted by the medications. And I understand
it's
difficult to find such a group. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Robert. Sorry.
Well, what I'm saying, I mean, the question I'm asking is, are there any studies of that, insofar as you can find such a group of people who are classified as schizophrenics or depressives or mentally ill, who are not, you know, heavily medicated? Because the medication, of course, as I think has been agreed, changes the, you know, it results in all kinds of additional, you know, changes in the dopamine and the serotonin receptors and transmitters, and that results in, you know. Now, independently of that, can we then say this is the abnormal brain, you know, free of any kind of drug problems? Now we can say, we can at least begin with that and say there's a place to go. I don't think that's likely. I mean, I don't see the problems in that way, but maybe there is such a thing. Maybe that's one way to go, you know.
Well, no, what you'll hear is, I think you used a key phrase there. Is there anything sort of uniquely different showing up in these patient groups? The answer is no. Now, what you might hear people say is, well, in a group of schizophrenia patients, even those not medicated, this area of the brain, it seems, in general, lights up less than the, you know, that it's, quote, normal. Or maybe that this area of the brain seems a little bit smaller, a tiny bit smaller than, let's say, the frontal lobes. I mean, there's a tiny bit of evidence that, that maybe in unmedicated patients, the frontal lobe of schizophrenia patients is a little bit smaller once you average that than, quote, normal. But, you know, that could be due to stress, that sort of thing. But there's nothing specifically unique that has come up where you say, okay, the problem in schizophrenia is this region of the brain, that's what shows up as different on scans, so we can sort of focus on fixing that, quote, pathology. There's nothing like that. There's this sort of vague sense that something might be different, but that's very different from saying, we have identified a unique pathology.
Now, one of the reasons that I think this has been really important for a lot of folks, maybe for you too, your work in this field, is the huge explosion in psychiatric medication over the last 20 years, and also particularly among children. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, I think You've now raised a question that is as important a question that could be raised in our society today. And I just can't emphasize how profound I think this question is. So we are now medicating kids left and right, right? And this has been really got rolling in, you know, late 1980s. And it's even hard to figure out what percentage of kids are medicated today with psychiatric drugs. I think it's now above 10%. It might even be like 15% of kids. It is an extraordinary amount. And I mean, percentage. And some of the kids are being hit with, you know, multiple drugs. You're seeing more and more heavy use of antipsychotics. So we are giving drugs to children who have no known problem, no known pathology. And these, of course, you know, the brain is always sort of reshaping itself somewhat. I mean, it's extraordinarily plastic. But in kids, it's still a developing brain. The frontal lobes are still developing. So much of the brain is still developing in response to its environment. Now, we're putting this drug in there, and the brain is going to change in response to that drug. And I will tell you this, say with antipsychotics, it's, there's quite clear evidence now that these drugs, you know, cause brain tissue shrinkage over time. So is that a good thing to be doing to kids? I think there's pretty good evidence that antipsychotics cause cognitive decline over time in the aggregate. Should you be doing that to kids? So we have launched this extraordinary, at best you can say, is this extraordinary experiment on kids in which we are changing their brains. We are changing how their brain develops. We are changing the trajectory of their life. And I think it is, well, the outcomes it's producing are just horrible. I mean, I don't even have to say I think. The outcomes are bad. What you see in the kids so medicated, you see sort of increasing psychiatric symptoms. If you follow them long term, you see physical problems. Again, if you follow those on antipsychotics long enough, you see cognitive problems. Those kids, by the way, that placed on antipsychotics at early ages, and if you keep them on those drugs long-term, they're going to be dying at age 30, 35. So this is one of the, in my opinion, a medical misadventure of epic scale that this widespread medicating of kids, particularly with antipsychotics, it's going to be seen as...
So, Robert, are you saying...
For 15, 20 years from now, we're going to be saying, good God, what have we done?
Wow. You have evidence, then, that the average age span of a person who's on medication from childhood is 30 or 35 years?
No, here's what you have in terms of this early death data. So there was a report out a while back, I don't think it was about 2 years ago, that the, quote, seriously mentally ill are now dying 25 years earlier than normal. They're dying in their 50s, right? 55, 56, that sort of thing. And they're dying of cardiac problems, respiratory problems, cancers, etc. And at least some of these are clearly related to the drugs, which can cause obesity, diabetes, etc. And that early death problem is getting more pronounced as we're using cocktails. Well, now you're seeing that in people who maybe were medicated initially at age 20 or age 25 or at age 30, that early death problem. That's number one. Number two, I just at this meeting I was at today, someone from California, they did a survey of their clients and looked at those who had died, and the average age of death was 41. 41. And again, that's people who were initially medicated probably when they were 20, 25. The early death problem, if you look at the risk of death for schizophrenia patients over the last 30 years, they've always had this thing of sort of their increase of death due to physical problems outside of suicide. Well, in the 1980s, it was like 1.8 times what was normal. In the 1990s, it went to 2.8 times normal. Then it went above 3. So the early death problem is becoming more pronounced. So I don't know what age these children are going to die, but what you can begin to worry about and extrapolate is this. How long can a human being live on antipsychotics, atypical antipsychotics? Well, if people who go on these antipsychotics at age 20 are dying at age 55, well, what's going to happen to that child who goes on an atypical antipsychotic at 5 years old? Is he going to live to 30, 35, 40? Well, I don't really know. But if people today are dying at age 41, those are people who are put on drugs later in life. So you really have to worry that their life will even be shorter.
So
by the way, I raised this question with some people who know a lot about antipsychotics, psychiatrists.
Uh-huh.
I said, how long do you think they will be living? They said, we don't know. That's the question that we should be asking. And I said, well, 30, 35, 40. They said, a couple of people said, yeah, that'd be my bet. That'd be my guess.
Talking about the kids.
Talking about when you're medicating five-year-olds with atypical antipsychotics, and you're going to keep those kids on that drug long term. Yes, how long will they live on that regimen of drugs? That's what they're saying. That's what they're guessing, speculating, that sort of thing.
Now, again, give us the figures for the explosion of antipsychotics on kids over the last 20 years.
Boy, I wish I just did this, and I'm going to have to apologize. I got so many numbers running in my head, but I think it's something now like, you know, first of all, by the way, before 1990, you didn't put kids on antipsychotics because it was understood that the old standard neuroleptics were so problematic. You know, the only place you had a risk-benefit analysis that seemed to work was with psychotic adults, right? I mean, that was the only place. But then the atypicals came to market with this sort of belief or marketing hype that they were so safe. They're safe. I mean, it's just nonsense. They have really problematic side effect profiles. But I think it's now something like 2% of all kids are on antipsychotics, something like that. And if you get into the foster care populations, it goes higher. And if you go into foster care populations at the teenage years, yeah, I mean, it's extraordinarily high. It's like 20%, I think, 30% are on atypical antipsychotics, foster kids in their teen years. It is just mind-boggling.
Is there a correlation, again, getting back to one of the main things you're pointing out on the anatomy of an epidemic? By the way, we're talking with Robert Whitaker, all you folks out there who just tuned in. He's an author who's been in Santa Cruz talking with the mental health community. I'm not sure exactly the group you talked to, Robert.
Well, I talked to different groups. I talked to some basically psychiatrists in Santa Clara who, you know, have connections to the county and, you know, see sort of Medi-Cal patients. That was, I don't even know what day it is today, Thursday. That was Wednesday morning, and then Wednesday afternoon I spoke to a more public group at Santa Clara, and then today I spoke to a group of psychiatrists. It's an association of psychiatrists that direct, they're medical directors of mental health services at a county level, different counties across.
Yeah, you actually talked to the Santa Cruz group yesterday, but.
Yeah, Santa Cruz yesterday, sorry, on Wednesday.
And I'm kind of curious about that group, and I talked to a few people who sat in on your session. I as I mentioned in the email, I tried to get it filmed, and I thought I had, you know, I mean, videoed, and I thought I had permission, and they decided against it, and so forth. But I understand that you spent an hour or two talking about the issues you've been talking about here, perhaps other issues too. Then you got a response or an additional presentation by a local psychiatrist.
That's right.
And then there was dialogue with people in the audience, clients, workers, and folks. Anything interesting come out of that discussion?
Well, I thought the discussion was great, first of all. I thought it was really terrific, with lots of different perspectives and thoughtful perspectives. And it was really sort of a probing discussion in terms of trying to think what we might do differently. And when I say we, I mean we as a society. I think there was a lot of thought that, almost agreement that we really should be changing things. And what we should have is a system of care that really focuses on psychosocial support, you know, and what that means in many ways, helping everything from jobs, shelter, food, helping build social networks with if people get isolated. And then as an adjunct, you might have drugs and medications, and you try to figure out who needs them and for how long and some sort of selective use protocols. But I think there was something of a consensus around that type of paradigm, which is so different than the paradigm we have now.
Do you have any indication of the extent to which the Santa Cruz authorities, like mental health authorities, prescribe drugs?
Well, I have a sense that, you know, right now medications are at the cornerstone of their care, and that they regularly prescribe drugs, are expected to prescribe drugs, and that they fairly regularly keep people on medications. Those are the regimens. I think your doctors here may be a little bit more open than in other areas of the country to listening to, you know, clients, especially clients who may want to taper off their medications or taper down their medications. It did seem that the psychiatrists I came into contact with, at least they expressed to me a much more willingness to do that, openness to that. The psychiatrist who spoke yesterday I thought was great. I mean, I thought he was a really empathetic, thoughtful, honest, really great guy. Go ahead.
You aren't getting then, in radio you want debates and dialogue and clashing and slashing and, you know, the points of disagreement as well as the points of agreement. But I know we've talked in the past of trying to get you on the air with a real advocate of psychiatric drugging like E. Fuller Torrey, who doesn't return my emails, and who I guess has never debated you as far as I know. But have you found? But you did. You have found that kind of debate has happened in some places you've gone to, and that's kind of rare, right? That is that for all the last decade, in spite of your two books, that hasn't really happened until recently. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that is accurate, and I'm not sure. I don't really think there's yet been a good debate. I would say that would be a great thing, is if you could sort of have a formal thing. Is there a response to my book? So my book lays out evidence that says, in the aggregate, medications worsen long-term outcomes. They shift outcomes to sort of more chronic disorders, that sort of thing. And the debate that would be good is if you'd have a scientific debate, and the other side would say, no, that's not right, and here's our evidence showing that the medications improve long-term outcomes. Now, the reason I don't think there's been a debate, my book came out last April, and in various forums there's been this criticism. Oh, he's cherry-picking the data, he's finding these particular studies, but there's all these other studies out there that show that drugs are improving long-term outcomes. But nobody actually names such a study. It's always as if there's some mythical group of studies that show improved long-term outcomes, as if they must be out there. But nobody has named any such study. And yesterday there was a moment in Santa Cruz where that criticism of me was made. Oh, you know, you're cherry-picking. There's all these other studies that show the drugs tremendously help people over the long term. So what I said is, if you have that data, please bring it forward. I looked for it, and I couldn't find it. And I said this to the room as a whole. If anybody knows such a study, let me know. Cite it right now. And nobody could. And this is what's happened, in essence, in the various sort of semi-debate forums I've been at. It's not like people have been able to bring forth these studies showing the opposite. And I think that's why there hasn't been a debate.
Well, I know in Massachusetts General, which I was able to, I read some of the commentary. There was a claim that either they're criticizing your Finnish study, or they were claiming there was I wish I had, the expertise and the time and the patience to try to act like devil's advocate here, for the other side, so that I could, hear your responses. Are you saying that no studies have been presented at all, ever, in any of these forums to you that would claim that long-term outcomes are better, or that figures are...
No, this is great. This is great. Because the one forum that maybe it did happen was the forum when I was giving MGH grand rounds, okay?
Massachusetts General Hospital.
Yeah, Massachusetts General Hospital. So I was invited to that forum. I was told, your book is important. Please come and you present your data on how antipsychotics shape the long-term outcomes of schizophrenia. And so I thought we were going to have a very sort of reasoned discussion about that. And then, like 2 days before, or shortly before, I was told, and there will be a department response. I said, okay, that's great. And again, I thought we were really going to focus on the outcomes literature. And then shortly before the actual day was held, I was sent these slides. And it was really just this extraordinary attack on me, an ad hominem attack, and on the book, et cetera.
Did they get into your sex life at all? Or?
No, they didn't get into that. But they did. This is interesting, and I think this is really telling. And by the way, if your listeners want to go on and sort of see the merits of what MGH presented, they can go on my website, madinamerica.com. The whole slides from the MGH I put up on my website, okay? So I want that aired. And here's the amazing thing. So what did MGH... It's the leading supposedly, I think, the top-rated psychiatric department in the country. What did they do as a counter to this long history of research I provide, of NIMH studies, etc.? Well, they presented and they misrepresented a study that had been done in China in, like, 1992. And they claimed that this study showed that drug-treated patients did better than non-drug-treated patients. But here was the study, and this shows, it was so ridiculous. It didn't show anything. What happened is these researchers went into this Chinese community of about 120,000 people, and they asked the local people, okay, who are the crazy people in your community? I mean, that's basically what they did. And through that survey, they identified something like 512 people that were, quote, schizophrenic. Now, as they went through that group of 512 people, they found this group, I don't know, it was 125 people, I don't know the number, but over 100 something, that were still crazy and had never been treated, not with herbs, not with anything. And that group, on average, had been sort of crazy for 12 years, and it was an older group. It was about 48 years old. Now, the important thing to understand here is, if someone had gotten crazy at age 35 or 36, not been treated, and those symptoms had resolved, they would no longer be in this group that was actively crazy, right? So you're self-selecting for patients who weren't treated and didn't get better and still crazy. All right, then they found this small group of people, of 30 people, who were younger, hadn't been crazy nearly so long, been treated with antipsychotic medications, and they said that group, when we came into the village, wasn't as psychotic as this untreated group was. And that's what the evidence, they said, is the evidence that contradicts all this long history of NIMH studies.
That was
our response. That's not a study.
They essentially ignored the fact that potentially a much larger number of people who are untreated without treatment got well, but a small percentage didn't, and then they claimed that they compared that to the select group that were treated with medication that did somewhat better.
Well, yeah, they just ignored the possibility that, mm-hmm. that there's this group of people that had psychosis and got better. That's not what they're looking at. They just came in, who's still psychotic? Well, who was still psychotic? They had this group of people that, in essence, the group that didn't resolve. But here's the other thing. So exactly, we don't know what percentage of people in the past 15 years became psychotic and then got better, because they wouldn't have showed up in this survey when the researchers came to this Chinese village, because they wouldn't have been actively crazy. So they were self-selecting for people still crazy and had never been treated.
So at Massachusetts General, when they presented you with this study, which, by the way, probably is a little hard for people who aren't, you know, poring over this as we speak. It's a little hard for me. I know. Maybe it's not. This was the only study that in your discussions in different places has been presented to refute what you've done. Or what you haven't really done much. You've collated.
Yes, that's the study that was presented as a counterpoint. Remember, that's not even a study over time. That's just a moment. That was the study presented by MGH to counter study after study after study that I presented that told us
no one has taken your book and said, okay, let's look at each of these studies. This one works, this one kind of works, this one's bullshit, he's misinterpreting this one is okay. No one has gone through with a fine-tooth comb and done that and then published those results or even spoken to you about that.
No, the one study that they're focusing on, I mean, when I present, so I go through these studies, the defenders of the faith, so to speak, will sort of complain about every study. Oh, the N is too small in that study. Or, you know, they'll just sort of come up with objections to every study.
Right.
But, you know, what you want to say is, well, okay, you're criticizing study after study after study. This is the NIMH that did these studies. It went through peer review to get, published. Obviously, they had to present this to the NIMH to get funded.
National Institute of Mental Health.
Mental Health, right. So if there's study flaws, and there may be, or weaknesses, there's always limitations to studies. Now, that's not my fault. In other words, what we have to do is, well, what research do we have, and what does the research show? It may have limitations. But let me tell you, well, go ahead, Robert, because there's one study they're picking. They're saying, I am somewhat misinterpreting.
Well, again, it doesn't really help us for an audience that's relatively untutored in these things to get into the specifics of the study. It might help you and I talking about it, but we're talking to a broader audience. And by the way, you're listening to Robert Whitaker, author of Mad in America, An Anatomy of an Epidemic, and you are tuned to Free Radio at 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. And there is a call-in number, I hope, which will enable you to ask a question or two or three or four of Robert Whitaker here. And that phone number is 831-469-3119, 831-469-3119. Or you can also email me at rnorse3@hotmail.com, rnorse3@hotmail.com, and I will attempt to forward questions. And I'm going to be looking at these now. Has there been, you mentioned your appearance at Massachusetts General Hospital, which I was impressed to read about, because now it seems that people, as I said, are inviting you here and there. Has there been any impact that you've seen in terms of how psychiatric departments may be changing their policies or practices or contributing to different methods of therapy that involve other kinds of healing than simply throwing drugs at people?
Well, there is some sort of seed for change of that. What happened is I started getting calls from people around the country, psychiatrists, administrators, basically providers of care, whether they be psychiatrists or administrators, who read the book and they said, boy, we really need to think about this. This is a solidly researched book. We need to think about doing things differently. So I put those people together on sort of an email list. They begin conversing in that way. And then in, I think this was about a month ago, beginning of February, yeah, that's when it was, those people got together in Portland, Oregon, and held a conference, a symposium, and a workshop, basically to talk about, okay, we have this long-term outcomes literature that Whitaker reviewed. How might we do things differently? So there was a workshop on schizophrenia that talked about using the medications in a different way. There was a workshop on depression that also talked about maybe sort of initiating use of medications in a much more cautious manner.
Now, unlike the Santa Cruz forum, which was not recorded, thank you very much, Santa Cruz authorities, was this forum recorded so that it maybe can be posted online, people can review it, take a look at it, listen to it?
No, the workshops, there were four different workshops that wasn't recorded. Frankly, they didn't want it recorded because they wanted the doctors to be able to speak. The psychiatrists, I mean, there were consumers there, there were psychiatrists there, there were administrators there. It was 50 people from around the country. I think there was 17 different states. And they wanted to have a real free-willing discussion. But they are that, and there was also, there's been a foundation that has formed to help promote this change and that sponsored this first workshop.
And what is that foundation?
It's called the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. It has a board of about 11 people. It's a mixed board. There's some psychiatrists on it. There's a couple consumers on it, people with lived experiences. There's some administrators on it. There's some philanthropists on it. There's a mom on it.
They got a website?
They haven't publicly sort of presented themselves yet. They are in the process of developing a website, and they will be putting up on this website, for example, the consensus statements that were arrived at and at that Portland conference that called for medications to be used in a different manner, and at the same time began to call for other therapies, such as whether it be psychotherapy or, attention to diet, attention to exercise. There was also one of the workshops was devoted to medication tapering, so they want to put some up on the website about what the consensus statement was out of that workshop. So it's just a seed for change, but their hope is and their intention is they will raise money and they will become a new voice in American society for change and an important voice.
Well, this is certainly a change from 5 years ago when you were you couldn't even get your publisher to consider Anatomy of an Epidemic as a book, right?
Yeah, I think at that time it was thought that this is too radical. This sort of big picture look. Yeah, I think things are changing. And I think what's happening is everywhere there's so much data piling up that says this medical model where you put medications for everybody for life at the sort of centerpiece of your response, and you have over here to the side these sort of psychosocial interventions and support. I think there is growing and widespread acknowledgement that is a broken system of care. It doesn't work.
Now, in Street Spirit article, which I thought was an excellent article, and I think it's still online for those who want to try to, if you Google for Robert Whitaker Street Spirit, I think you can find, there was only 1 year when the homeless newspaper Street Spirit published online, and this is, I think, one of those years, and we may be lucky there. You mentioned the rather, if I'm remembering the article correctly, the grim treatment that certain researchers received when they spoke against the psychiatric and pharmaceutical orthodoxy, being fired, otherwise harassed, and censored. I don't know if you remember. I think a couple of particular researchers you referred to.
Yeah, sure, that's true.
How is that situation? Has it exacerbated? Has it changed? Has it become more less prevalent? Or is the same thing happening while other things are happening?
Now, that's a great question. I don't know if I can, how fully I can answer that. I think here's what's happened. Yes, those cases happened. They became sort of known. And I think in many ways, psychiatry became quite embarrassed by that. By psychiatry, I mean many psychiatrists, many in the field see that as shameful.
Yeah, and then summarize those cases very briefly, because I don't think most people know what we're talking about.
Okay, the first one that we go back to is Lauren Mosher, who was head of schizophrenia studies in late 70s, 1980s. He ran a famous program called the Soteria Project, which was in this area, by the way. And he reported that this sort of experimental form of care where people with first break psychosis went and stayed in a house and were cared for by people who could just be with people, and you used antipsychotics in a much more minimal fashion, he showed that produced better two-year outcomes than conventional care. He reports this, and what happens? He gets booted from the NIMH. Head schizophrenia doctor in the country gets booted for reporting a better form of care. That, and the reason, of course, is that goes against, you know, the commercial interests of psychiatry in a certain sense. And really this rise of biological psychiatry. And his firing, by the way, did signal two things. It signaled sort of the death of social psychiatry, and it was a real warning to researchers. If you go against this medical model, your career may suffer.
Has anyone in the last couple of years stood up to this issue and publicly challenged it, other than long-term critics of psychiatric drugs like Peter Bragan? And I've seen actually a rash of books, which you and I talked about a little bit on emails, that have come out critiquing psychiatric medications. But have there been individuals now on hospital staffs or in national associations who have stood up and said, this needs to be examined, this needs to be considered, or even taken the position that you're taking, which is that there are psychiatric medication may be good for some, but certainly the current situation isn't?
Right. Well, the most notable example of someone who was basically speaking in that way was David Healy. Now, who's David Healy? David Healy is a psychiatrist from Wales, but a prominent psychiatrist in the UK. And he also was within the bosom of psychiatry for a long time. And he probably had written more books about the history of psychopharmacology from a mainstream point of view, even sort of celebrating many of the people involved, than any other psychiatrist, any other writer that you know of. So, mainstream guy. And then what happens in the 1990s is he begins to be worried that antidepressants, in fact, can stir suicidal behavior. He does some experiments on that, some research on that. He becomes convinced that, yes, antidepressants in certain people can stir homicidal and suicidal behavior. So he's a prominent guy. He gets a contract to move from Wales to, I think it's to head up the mood disorders program at the University of Toronto. So this is a prominent position. He gets hired. He goes through and he gets his papers in order. And then he goes to give a lecture about 4 months before he's going to move to the University of Toronto. But he goes to Toronto to give this lecture, and he brings forth this data. And I forget exactly what year this was. But anyway, he presents this data. By the time he got back to Wales, the job offer had been rescinded. And it was like the head of the department there saying, you know, and unfortunately, I don't think your interests and our interests are mesh.
I remember this story, which actually you wrote about, or actually you spoke about, and others then transcribed in 2005. And I guess my question to you is, have things changed? Are there figures who are now coming forward who aren't being dumped, who aren't being fired, who aren't suffering economic, deprivation or, consequences for this?
I think there are. That's a great question. I don't think anybody has stepped forward in the way that David Healy stepped forward. And I think there are plenty of people who would worry about stepping forward. On the other hand, in terms of whether we're sort of approaching a sea change, again, most psychiatrists were embarrassed by what happened to Healy. They see it as a blot on, the field's good name. So, and there's also been, as you know, with the Charles Grassley's reports on all the money going to sort of top thought leaders in psychiatry and how that has corrupted some of their scientific reports, that also has really raised awareness that psychiatry as a field academic psychiatry got bought by the pharmaceutical companies, that has produced this sort of shameful spinning of results, hiding of adverse events. And because of that, I think psychiatry is ready to at least somewhat move in a new direction. And if someone steps forward and says, maybe Whitaker's, I'm going to present data that supports what Whitaker's analysis, I'm not sure he would suffer so much, or he or she would suffer so much.
Well, you
today
certainly are getting funded to go to different places and talk in a way that wasn't the case after Mad in America. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. So that shows something's changing.
And in addition to that, have you been following books that have come out critical of psychiatry from different perspectives in the last few years?
Yeah, and boy, there is an increasing number of such books. If you go into your local bookstore, the critiques are coming, I'd say, ever more fast and furious, and they're coming from different angles. So I think that also speaks to some sort of growing chorus saying, boy, something's going wrong here. But I'll tell you where it's hard to really crack. It's not like the newspapers or even the magazines really. They'll sort of nibble around the edges of sort of the merits of medications. But by and large, they're pretty close to the idea that challenges the conventional story that the medications brought this great advance in care. In other words, that's still, I'd say, the reigning belief system within the magazines and newspapers, and they're not very open to the challenges to that belief.
What about the pharmaceutical companies who are profiting from this? Are they getting nervous, or do you think they're pretty self-assured about their ability to continue along with what they're doing?
I think they're getting extraordinarily nervous, but actually not so much because they're worried about all these complaints will kill the market for the drugs, because our appetite for these drugs, sales of the drugs are just extraordinary to me. But really what they're nervous about is that their drugs will go off patent, they'll face generic competition, and they really don't have a lot of promising compounds in research. So in trials, in development. So I think they're worried that this gravy train, which has been so important to the finances of many major pharmaceutical companies, may be coming to an end.
Now, what about the funding for the actual psychiatric establishment that is, still pushing these drugs in a major way, whether it's government funding or funding from foundations or funding from charities, or funding from the public? I mean, is that continuing to increase, continuing to sustain itself? And if it is, what's the way to stop it?
I'm sorry, Robert, I missed that. Is there funding sort of for the continued development of the medical model and the use of these drugs?
Well, mainly, I'm thinking of kind of the expansion of the prescription of these drugs, both to young and old. It's getting funded from somewhere. I mean,
sure. I mean, that's really, of course, it's basically a commercial enterprise. The ultimate source is the pharmaceutical industry. And
the psychiatric industry, because they're the ones who are the consumers, right? I mean, they're the ones who are saying to the public, you have to have this in order to be well.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's just, that still exists. I mean, that storytelling apparatus where pharmaceutical companies pay money to thought leaders, so-called thought leaders, who are psychiatrists at academic medical centers and therefore have a lot of prestige. There's still a lot of funding of those individuals. They serve as, quote, advisors to pharmaceutical companies. They serve as consultants. They serve on speaker boards. So that storytelling apparatus, I would say, is still going full throttle. It still very much serves to expand markets, serves to expand belief that these medications are...
What's the role of
fixing diseases, that sort of thing.
Right. Well, what's the role of the government in this, state and federal and local?
Well, the role that the government has been playing, and let's just say the National Institute of Mental Health has been playing for so long, is the National Institute of Mental Health, in a way, got captured by biological psychiatry in the late 1980s. And by that I mean the APA was able to put forward and get into the position of the directorships of the NIMH psychiatrists who very much embraced the medical model and wanted to see research done, really focused on drug research and focused on identifying molecules in the brain that could be the targets for new drugs, that sort of thing.
Let me cut this short and say, how much government money is actually going to support, I don't know, hospitals, pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, around the medical model? And is that continuing to grow? Or is there any sense in which Congress, local legislatures, bureaucrats who have power over the finances are taking a second look at this funding?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the amount of money that's spending, and I don't know if it's continuing to grow. But I do know that so much of it remains focused on the medical model and supporting biological treatments for mental disorders and supporting the idea that we're going to do research that identifies the pathology of these disorders.
I mean, a lot of the thing I do on this program, often I criticize the huge, I don't know, what is it, $2 billion a day that goes to the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's just Afghanistan, actually, these days. Iraq, it's another, I don't know how much. But I'm wondering if government money is going directly into, I don't know, hospitals, pharmaceutical companies, and other institutions in support of psychiatric medications in some way.
It's certainly going into academic medical centers to fund research into, quote, the biological causes of these disorders.
Right. I mean, absolutely. Not just research, but the grants to hospitals to help people, the grants to help low-income people, for example, Medi-Cal, Medicare.
Sure. I mean, of course. I mean, spending, if you're talking about that, I'm sorry, I missed you. I guess I'm so tired here. Spending on mental health services in the country rose from $85 billion in 2001 to $170 billion in 2007. Of that spending, roughly was 60% was by the federal government. So it's 60% of 85, what is that, $50 billion? In 2001, the government spent on mental health services, and this is, I think, both state and federal government spending, through Medicaid, Medi-Cal, that sort of thing. And in 2007, it's 60% of 170, so what is that? Over $100 billion. So sure, there's a lot of spending on this medical model, spending on psychiatric drugs, and in fact, government spending on psychiatric drugs is what's breaking, a lot of state budgets.
So is there any, I guess I'm looking for, I guess you would be mentioning them if there were any voices in the wilderness or even, in the seats of power that are asking for other avenues, other ways to proceed. I mean, it's always encouraging to hear, you're talking with the big boys in Massachusetts and even the big boys in Santa Cruz and some of the big girls, too.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering how this – I want to also get a realistic perception of whether the juggernaut has really been slowed or whether it's continuing its increasing pace.
No, that's good, Robert, because, of course, it's been – this juggernaut has just been sort of enveloping more and more people into its maw, so to speak. By that I mean is you expand diagnostic boundaries, you get more people on the drugs, you get more kids on the drugs. Actually, I'd say the juggernaut's still pretty operative. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can be in certain corners where they're talking about medicating, 6-month-olds or just crazy stuff. You'll see the juggernaut operating in terms of saying that women who are pregnant need to keep on their antidepressants, even as research shows that, that can affect the fetus. So yeah, sometimes I'm trying to be optimistic here. But is the commercial juggernaut still operating? Yes. Is the government, the federal government, NIMH, really helping to support that juggernaut? Yes. Is there much in government where they're saying, like, this system really isn't working and we got to rethink the medical model? No. What they might say is, well, we need to put some more effort into psychosocial services. But there's no real, within the government, willingness to challenge medicines as a cornerstone of care. So, no.
I notice in your book you mentioned Thomas Szasz, that ancient critic. I guess he's not really a critic of psychiatric medication, but he's a critic of the whole model of mental illness. His famous 1961 book, The Myth of Mental Illness, and you kind of point him out as one of the reasons that psychiatrists may have kind of regrouped in the 70s and 80s against the anti-psychiatry movement in order to kind of increase their prestige. Though, as you may also know, Zaz has recently written a book called Anti-Psychiatry Quackery Squared. He doesn't regard himself as an anti-psychiatrist at all. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah, well, I don't know about this book, but I never saw him as an anti-psychiatrist. I mean, he was really coming at this something from a libertarian point of view.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know his new book, but I you know, there was sort of a philosophical sense to him as well. But going forth, I mean, Zaz did very much influence the course of psychiatry because his method of mental illness, which I think was published in 1964, was quite an influential book. And it was actually treated at that time as a, you know, even by the mainstream media, as something of a reasonable critique of psychiatry. It shows how far things have changed. And so, in response, psychiatry in the 1970s, you know, it felt itself under attack from many different corners. It felt itself under attack by anti-psychiatrists. It also felt itself under attack by Zaz's critique, which these aren't really medical disorders. These are, you know, you're talking about whether or not people are behaving within the confines of the law, that sort of thing.
He was concerned that that people not be. He's a major opponent of involuntary commitment and also of the insanity defense. That was, I guess, his two major angry objections, and he's been fighting that battle for 40 years now.
Yeah, he's basically saying people are responsible for their actions, right? I mean, legally responsible. Well, that's really what, in my opinion, at the heart of the critique there is that, you know, people are responsible for their behaviors. I mean, legally, et cetera. And but because they're responsible for their behaviors in terms of forced medication, the state has no right to forcibly medicate somebody under the guise of, you know, this person's psychotic or have this schizophrenia, et cetera. If they've misbehaved in a way that if they break the law, then they should be adjudicated by the law. I think that's part of his critique. Going forward, what happens was, in response to that, the Zazian critique and some of the anti-psychiatry critique, psychiatry really sort of hunkered down and said, you know, we got to publicly put on the white coat and we got to say our disorders are real disorders just like cancer and diabetes, and sort of take refuge in that image of the infectious disease doctor.
Yeah, that's what I was reading as I zipped through your book before the show. We're talking with Robert Whitaker, who's still with us, in case you want to catch him in the next 10 minutes before he runs to catch a plane. I guess you're headed out of town. That's the
I'm headed to New Jersey tonight, so yeah, I do have to catch a plane in about 10 minutes.
Yeah, the phone number here, if you want to ask him a question, is 469-3119, 469-3119. And we've also done interviews in the past, which I think have also been good and are still, I think, worth listening to. And you can catch those if you go to huffsantacruz.org. That's the website, huffsantacruz.org. And then click on the name of the show, Bathrop Spears Broadsides, and then search for Whitaker, and you'll find him in the midst of all those old interviews. So do you have a schedule that's pretty full now in terms of lots of talks lined up? And are you is your future assured as a As a struggling champion, or should we say the David against the Goliath of the in a real way.
So I do have a lot of talks sort of scheduled through mid-June, and then I actually have some talks in the fall again. But so yes, I certainly have a lot of talks coming up. But at some point,
paid
frankly,
talks.
I'm going to have to start making a living again.
They're going to pay your airfare to these talks.
You know, they'll pay my travel expenses, but, you know, that's it. I mean, every once in a while I get an honorarium.
You don't pay your rent, in other words. It's not...
No, I mean, this is a disaster financially.
So are you working on another book now?
No, I need to. I really
need
to.
Well,
get
to
work. I need to get doing that first. You're going to get to that fast. The problem is I've been so busy running around speaking.
If people wanted to, you know, pursue some of the areas of research that you began but couldn't pick up on because you were, you know, you had a limited amount of time and energy, what aspects do you think need to be delved into next to push this
the story forward.
The agenda of, you know, giving people the choice of...
Well, not only that, how about developing systems that are more humane and more person-centered and really help people get well and get their lives back.
Right. What's the next book you'd write if you had, three people doing it for you, you know?
Well, the book I really want to do, and let's see if I can get a contract to do it, is I'd like to run around the world and find sort of systems of care that have sort of documented outcomes that, you know, have this humanistic approach that either, you know, but basically have a humanistic approach and have good outcomes and that are following different modalities, different philosophies, and can show that they are very successful in helping people, whether it be depression or, manic depressive illness or psychosis, and are show that they're very effective. And not, and by effective, I mean, you know, helping people get through whatever momentary acute crisis they have, but also help them, go on to lead these productive, robust lives. To write about the philosophy underlining some of those programs. And I'll give you an example. You know, I spent some time in the upper Amazon a few years back, and I stayed with the shaman there. Now, they have a very different conception of life, philosophy, and madness, and what it means to, you know, hear voices. But because their philosophy is so different about hearing voices, where they do have the philosophy that, you know, you may be convening with your ancestors or conversing with your ancestors or conversing with the spirits, that it's not something to be feared, but in some ways to be embraced. And because of that, at least in the larger community I was in, it's not like they have crazy people. By that I mean they have no people identified as, you know, people who can't function in society because they're too crazy. Well, I'd say that's a successful outcome, right? In other words, they have a society that is able to incorporate, you know, all sorts of behaviors and thoughts. And they don't have documented outcomes by sort of Western medical standards, but nevertheless, that could be an example of something I would write about.
So which government is going to give you a grant, or which foundation is going to give you a grant to run around the world and do this?
Nobody. I have to convince my publisher, which is Crown, that this would be a good idea.
But
and
you,
so they would give me a nice advance and say, okay, Bob, go spend a year doing this.
How is your publisher feeling about the outcome of Anatomy of an Epidemic? Are they more positive than they were a few years ago?
Yes. I mean, I would say what they're happy about. Listen, publishers are businesses, right? And they want to see how many books you sell.
Mm-hmm.
If you would have called them up in, say, July of last year, the book had been out about 4 months, I think they would have been pretty disappointed because there was no big rush of sales. But now they're much happier because the book has had these what was called legs, and there's been these steady sales. And, you know, sales are getting pretty decent now. So that fact will make them more open to doing a book of the sort I just talked about.
So if this book becomes a textbook in universities, are you going to be able to, on the royalties, do the kind of work you want to do? Or?
No. The royalties are just never enough. The book business is just too tough. But hopefully I can get another contract that will allow me to write that next book. You really in this business, unless you have a big bestseller, you need to continually get good advances. But I will say this, I have some royalties that come from sort of steadily from my other books, so there's some steady income there.
Any new works on the subject of psychiatric medication or psychiatric practice in the U.S. that you think people should also look at if they want to broaden their understanding of this field?
Actually, I think one real good book was Ethan Waters' book on the globalization of psychiatry. I think, what is the title of the book? Boy, I'm so tired. Is it Crazy Like Us? He's a San Francisco-based writer who looked about how we took our medical model and the pharmaceutical companies basically exported that around the world, and too often not particularly good results. That's a real good sense about a good book about some of the commercial forces at work, I think. It's a book worth reading.
comments on the FDA's finally requiring ECT to actually undergo some kind of testing?
You know, that's a really interesting thing that's going on there. And I wouldn't say that I followed it real closely. And
by the way, ECT, for those who don't know, is electroshock therapy or electroconvulsive therapy. Go ahead.
Right. And, you know, electroconvulsive therapy was basically grandfathered in. By that I mean, you know, it was invented in the 1940s, long before we had any sort of assessment of medical devices, those sort of interventions. So it's never gone through sort of for safety and efficacy. And when these hearings were held, if I understand what happened, you had this group of doctors, and whereas the psychiatrists as a group all wanted it regulated as sort of a level 2 device, saying it was sort of low risk or immediate risk, and yes, we know it's effective, the non-psychiatrist physicians on that group were much more skeptical, and basically saying, you know, the determination was, listen, we don't even know if ECT is, quote, effective beyond 30 days. And two, you know, there's some real worry about cognitive function. So we had this, you know, here we are 70 years after ECT was introduced, this government panel that said, we don't even know if this is working beyond 30 days in terms of improving depression. And the reason they said that is because there is no good evidence that, in fact, it does improve the course of depression beyond 30 days, which is why people have to keep going for their maintenance. And they said there's real reason about, you know, the cognitive problems caused by this.
Yeah, but Time magazine likes it.
What's that? I'm sorry, I missed that, Robert.
I said Time magazine likes it.
They like ECT.
Yeah.
Well, all I can say is, yes, I know ECT has been making a comeback, and you'll see these articles about how modern ECT is so much better. All I can say is when that panel took a look at it, what emerged from there was some real questions about its long-term efficacy and its safety. And the beauty of this, not the beauty of this, is in the media, what you're just saying is, so the media was sort of getting on board with this idea that modern ECT is safer and effective, and it's really a very effective form of care. And then when this panel actually began to look at the literature, they couldn't find evidence that this was a, you know, led to a good long-term course. And one of the reasons they couldn't, by the way, there was some work with dental and a New Zealand guy, John Reed, that said, look at the evidence. In other words, they were looking at the evidence for ECT in much the same way I was looking for it for drugs, and they said, you do not see long-term benefit. When that was finally put before the panel, they said, yeah, we have a problem here.
Well, that leads me to the next kind of obvious question. Could a similar argument be made about psychiatric medications before the FDA and similar agencies?
That would be great if that happened. The problem is, of course, the drugs seemingly have passed they were approved for the market. They passed an FDA review process. So since that has happened, there doesn't seem to be any occasion to have that sort of panel and that sort of big picture review of the therapy. So unfortunately, I don't think it'll happen.
Have you done any research or read any research on the FDA's approval of these drugs in terms of whether there's incompetence, corruption, or new data that might lead them to change their perspective or that bias their perspective in the original case?
And by the way, I think my phone's about to quit, so, and I also have to run here in a second.
Sure.
You know, the answer to this is not really. However, I will say this. All of psychiatry, and to an extent the FDA, has been pretty embarrassed by the fact that the atypical antipsychotics were marketed as so much safer and more effective than the old drugs, and yet when governments tested the new drugs, that was not found to be the case. So that's been a real sort of embarrassment for the field. And I think there's a certain sense within the FDA of embarrassment there. I shouldn't say that. I don't know that to be true. I will say the field as a whole has been embarrassed by the fact those were seen as these sort of magic bullets, this great advance, when once they were tested by governments, that did not prove to be true.
Robert, thank you for hanging with us for an hour and a half. Good luck on catching your plane.
Okay, thanks very much for having me, Robert, and a great interview. I really enjoyed it.
Hey, good to have you, man.
Okay, thanks. Talk to you later.
And that was Robert Whitaker, author of Mad in America, An Anatomy of an Epidemic. All you callers missed him, but now you can call and talk to me. And, of course, I'm much more interesting. The call-in number here is either, well, let's do 427-3772 because he's no longer on the line, and you can call and talk to me. Before this all began, I was talking about the sleeping ban. I was talking about the law that criminalizes homeless people and the new city attorney's solution to the really abusive discrimination against homeless people, saying we're not going to allow you to sleep at night under a penalty of a crime. We've made it a crime in Santa Cruz for you to sleep on public property. But no longer are we going to do that, because courts and other cities have ruled badly on this issue. What we're doing instead is we're saying we're keeping the law, but we're saying if you're on a waiting list at the homeless service center, you can go get your ticket dismissed. Well, I just got an email this evening from a guy who tried to do that. That's a fellow named Robert Facer, and I mentioned how he had been really the cause that created Peace Camp 2010, the three-month protest against the law, the anti-homeless sleeping ban law, that eventually, we think, forced the city attorney to change the law and to say, in essence, okay, get on a waiting list and you can get your ticket dismissed. He tried to get on a waiting list, and he wrote me the following email. Let's see if I can actually pull it up here. Let's see here. Here is what he wrote. I'm sorry that I did not make it to the Huff meeting. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We meet every Wednesday. We met yesterday. I'll be talking more about the exciting outcome of our meeting on Sunday when I come back. That's a longer show. It'll be happening from 9:30 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon. Robert Facer writes, I'm sorry that I did not make it to the meeting. I was involved in a stew with a camping ticket from last September 20th. I was supposed to get a paper from the homeless shelter by 8:30 a.m. on March 10th. March 10th, of course, is today. I made it to the shelter on the 9th, Ash Wednesday, at 11:15 a.m. by camping, that would be illegally, near the place, so I did not have to walk too far. Robert is Amish. He goes everywhere on foot. Doesn't believe it's against his religion to use motor vehicles. And he doesn't have any horse to use. If anybody has a horse for Robert, hey, step forward. I found out not too much to my surprise that the person I was supposed to talk to was out sick for a couple of days. Right about then, I remembered that I missed another Huff meeting. Anyway, I asked about getting on a waiting list and was told that it was pointless, that there was no way I would ever get into the shelter, even if I wanted to, and if I came back between 2:30 and 3, then I could get on the waiting list. This I did not do because there is no way I could ever stay at their shelter, even if I wanted to, and because the drum circle started up. That happens in the afternoon on Wednesday downtown. I missed Baskets Court at 8:30 on the 10th. That was the court where you go when you get camping tickets, because I was washing my shirts anyway. I made it at 1:30 and told her I couldn't get up that early, so will she please not ever ask me to do that again. My next court date is 1:30 on the 28th, and he signs it Blind Bear. And you might say, well, if he's not going to get into shelter, then what's this business about getting on the waiting list? And the answer is, signing up for a waiting list, whether you're going into the shelter or not, is the way that that requires the city attorney to not file or dismiss citations against you under the city's 6.3601A sleeping ban and 6.3601AB blanket ban. Makes it illegal to cover up with a blanket after 11 o'clock at night, or set up bedding, as they like to describe it, or to camp with the intention of remaining overnight at any time with camping equipment, which could be a tent, it could even conceivably be a sleeping bag. But it appears that it was difficult for at least this man. I also heard a similar account from Todd Hill, and I played his account on the air, for people to sign up on this waiting list. So either there is some real difficulties that they're having when staffing over at the Homeless Service Center, or there is perhaps discrimination against a couple individuals. We know that last September people tried to get on the waiting list from Peace Camp 2010, the encampment outside first the county building and then City Hall, protesting the camping ordinance, and they were turned away. They were refused. And then when they came back, eventually one guy was able to sign up on the waiting list. And I think Colette Connolly, who's now a defendant, a 73-year-old defendant, who's going is facing 6 months in jail for peaceful protest against the camping ordinance, and she faces a jury trial in April along with five others, actually six others, if you include Linda LeMaster. She, too, tried to get on the waiting list, and I think she found herself bumped off. So there's a lot of troubles with this. Plus, when I try to get a straight story from Monica Martinez, who is the executive director of the Homeless Service Center, I get either silence or double talk, and that's difficult. I've posted some of my discussion, so you know that I'm not just I'm trying to be fair to Monica. She did have, I think, a couple of long conversations with me, but I simply wanted to get a clear statement. What is it required to get on the waiting list? Will you send out a letter that specifically says, we haven't had any room all summer for walk-in people, which they haven't. We asked for this letter as early as August because we needed it for people who are going to be charged with camping. We knew that the authorities were going to come down on people, even though they were engaging in legitimate peaceful protest, even though they were engaging in also legitimate survival camping behavior. And we needed evidence that we could say to court, look, this is a necessity, therefore these cases under the necessity defense should be thrown out. And Monica Martinez, apparently in collusion with the city attorney, and perhaps worried about offending then-Mayor Rotkin and now-Mayor Ryan Coonerty, refused to give us this letter, even though it was clearly accurate. So we're going to have to do eventually, those of us who are going to trial, and I'm not one of them. I wasn't arrested or cited, but there are others who I know very well who were, is subpoena her and or whoever has the records to come into court to testify. Yes, we stonewalled people for 8 months on this, but yes, now we have to admit that there was no space during this period of time. And I find it peculiar, infuriating, and in a way, though, quite comprehensible, similar to poverty pimps everywhere who are more concerned with teasing smiles out on the faces of their funders than they are with doing their job, which is, at the very least, being honest about their situation to the homeless clients that they supposedly are serving. And they're not, Martinez isn't doing this, nor is Letitia Schwartz or anybody else on that board of directors who we've approached and asked pretty straightforwardly to give a letter. We also asked that they have somebody there, and they do have somebody there at night, as I understand it, who will say, our shelter is full, to any police officer, homeless person, or member of the public calling in, so that the police officer will then have the option to say, you know, it'd be stupid for me to give you a camping ticket because I can't give you a legal place to go. So what I'm saying to you is you can't go to sleep at night, which is an unconstitutional form of cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and therefore I won't do it. Or if I do it, I have to risk some kind of lawsuit at some point in the game. And that is something that we haven't been able to get from Monica Martinez either. We also have asked that she give out some kind of paper documentation that a person, if they actually can get on the waiting list, is on the waiting list. I called it a receipt. And she won't do that either. So it's a difficult situation at the Homeless Service Center. It's not clear why we're having these problems, except that one can only surmise that they're attempting to maintain a cozy relationship with the police department, the city attorney's office, and the city council, and that this involves trying not to offend anyone by not being really clear that there's no shelter for the overwhelming majority of homeless people, and therefore the whole camping ordinance itself is not merely stupid and abusive, but a legal liability to the city of Santa Cruz. And, of course, that's really, I guess, only going to be shown when there's an effective and successful lawsuit, which could happen. It is not inconceivable, but it's a difficult thing to do. I've been trying to get records from the city offices about the Homeless Service Center, and they've been telling me they have no records. That was the first thing I heard from former city clerk Tom Graves. He's now, I guess he has a different title. He still does pretty much the same thing, or maybe Martine Bernal, the city manager, has taken on his functions. I got an unclear statement from Steve Plaich, who's been kind of researching this and came to the Huff meeting yesterday and talked to us about the issue. But I'm not getting, I got a response from Tom Graves that, well, we have nothing about the Homeless Service Center because it's a private organization. Well, it's very true that the Homeless Service Center is a nonprofit, but it gets funding from the city. It engages in regular communications with the city. Don Lane, the vice mayor, is on its board of directors, and so is Catherine Byers, a council member. So that's simply false statement by an official of the city. Kind of shocking. Although not really, if you've been dealing with the Santa Cruz city bureaucracy as long as I have. What's really important, though, of course, is to make it clear to the community what's going on, and then suddenly they start backtracking, and they start saying, oh, we found some strange missing records that indicate, yes, we do have some information about the Homeless Service Center. And, of course, one of the best ways to do this stuff is to do it with masses of people who show up in a line with signs and with a determination to stay there until they get the answers that they need from the bureaucrats who just don't want to give out those answers. That, however, does require organizing. It does require people who are willing to risk some discomfort, some confrontation, possibly a citation or even an arrest. And that's, you know, that's something that's easier to talk about than to do. For all of us, not just for those of us who have done it before, because, you know, it involves court time, it involves all kinds of potential risks and penalties, and it's a pain in the ass, for sure. So, I got about 4 minutes left in the show, and meandering into the studio early is the none other than, well, that man about music, Uncle Dennis. So, Dennis, what's coming up in your show?
Well, music.
We know that, Dennis. What kind of music?
Good music.
Perhaps we'll just have to wait until Dennis foists
good rock and roll music.
His good rock and roll music on us.
Psychedelic.
What kind of alcoholic beverages have you brought with you, or is that a secret?
I have to wait till about 8:30 to figure out what the brew of the week is.
Now, you haven't got any reports on local environmental news? Is that'll be coming up too, perhaps?
Yeah, that's at 9 o'clock. Earth First Update. Not only local environmental news, we also have news from around the world.
Any political prisoners we should be concerned about at this point?
There will be news about political prisoners, the Earth Liberation Prisoners Update. I have some updates from that. Unfortunately, it's not good news.
I'm sorry to hear it. Although I don't follow that as closely as I should, that is also an important issue. It would be great if we could talk about people who are actually in the Santa Cruz jail as well, because I happen to feel a number of those people are also political prisoners, particularly poor people who are there for no good reason. But that's about it.
The poor aren't political, Robert.
Certainly not.
They're just poor.
They are very poor, yes. So I will hopefully be returning. There was an interesting article, which I don't really have time to talk about, but maybe on Sunday when I come back. UK, I call it UK soup snatchers at work. Apparently, it isn't just Santa Cruz that attempts to drive the churches into stopping providing meals for homeless people, as former Mayor Cynthia Matthews has tried to do with Father Joel Miller, who recently went to ecclesiastical court, gave me a report on that. I'm hoping to give such a report on Sunday, although maybe I think he's asked me to defer that until another week, because that's when there's going to be a definitive answer to the attempt of a few parishioners to gentrify the whole downtown area next to the Red Church and essentially eliminate the homeless meal there. That'll be coming up on Sunday. And a week from Sunday, I hope to have on the online the Portland Street Roots writer who is going to talk about the sit-lie struggle up there, the law to, that they're dealing with and their sitting ban. They actually have had more success in fighting it than we have had here in Santa Cruz. Anyway, that's it for Bathrop's Piers Broadsides tonight. If you'd like to give any reports as to what's been happening on the streets, you can, 423-4833, 423-HUFF is the number to call if you'd like to do that. And I will pass those on to the radio community. And I'll also hopefully collate them myself. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. The show is archived at www.huffsantacruz.org, and I'll be back on Sunday at 9:30.